From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. When Minneapolis police officers killed George Floyd in a videotaped incident that made international headlines and sparked nationwide uprisings across the U.S., Palestinian Americans noted the disturbing similarity between the manner of Floyd's killing and how Palestinians are treated by Israeli forces. The similarity is not a coincidence, however, as activists working closely on the Israeli occupation of Palestine have pointed out for years that U.S. police departments have trained Israeli soldiers and learned their deadly tactics. While the U.S.-Israel relationship has been taken for granted as a part of U.S. foreign policy, in recent years, younger lawmakers have been questioning it. That was most recently seen in the primary election defeat of longtime pro-Israel Congressman Elliot Engel by newcomer Jamal Bowman in New York. My guest is Hoveda Araf, Palestinian-American lawyer and human rights activist, co-founder of the International Solidarity Movement, former chair of the Free Gaza Movement, currently our Palestine and Refugees correspondent. Welcome back to the show, Hoveda.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Sonali.
Before we talk about the election and what it means for the U.S., let's look at the broader issue of this very close relationship between American police departments, particularly departments like the NYPD, but also in Minneapolis, with Israeli forces. This is something that most Americans, particularly ones who are just now sort of seeing police violence as it is, may not be aware of.
That's true. It is something that's not widely publicized at all, although some human rights organizations have made statements about it and published reports, Amnesty International being one of them. There's also a Jewish Voice for Peace, which some of your listeners might know. It's a national movement of Jews who are opposed to Israel's policies of apartheid and colonialism, and they had a very effective campaign drawing attention to this police training called Deadly Exchange and working with different groups to try to pressure their cities and states to stop essentially these trainings, sending U.S. police officers over to Israel for training and having Israeli police and military forces come here to train our police officers. And as you noted, when Palestinian activists and others drew attention to the similarities, it was not to say that it is because of the training with Israel that we see American police officers being so violent and using deadly tactics against Black and brown bodies, because as we know, African Americans have been fighting this fight here in the United States for 400 years. And before the State of Israel was created, the system was racist and violent against Black people. But where we have come today, of course, we have a lot of work still to do, but we should be working on dismantling that racism. We should be working on abolition, if you ask me, but certainly atoning for this country's history, for what we've done to Black people, to the decades and centuries of violence. But instead of doing that, we are training with a systemic and systematic human rights abuser, and that is Israel. And every day there are reports coming out of Israel from human rights organizations about the latest violence against Palestinian civilians, and not just that there is this violence against Palestinian civilians, but that there is no accountability for it. So Israel can be as ruthless as it wants. It kills Palestinians with impunity, and that is what it is transferring to also American police forces.
It's quite remarkable to think about the fact that American police forces, for two decades, there has been a partnership with some departments and Israeli forces. They're learning the tactics of subduing suspects from a regime that is occupying another nation, and that is a known, as you said, abuser and violator of human rights. Amnesty International spokesperson said that with a long record of human rights violations, Israeli security forces are an incredibly problematic training partner. So the same tactics that Israel uses in an overt occupation that is internationally condemned are the tactics that American soldiers are using on American people. And it's no wonder that some people, particularly Black and brown communities, see American police as akin to occupying forces in their neighborhoods. There are parallels, right?
Exactly. And that, you know, what's even more disturbing is Israel being the occupying power and being a settler colonial state. These tactics that they use against the Palestinian people, they have part of their training and their mentality, sadly to say, is to dehumanize the people that they're using it against. So the Israeli police, for example, being present in Israeli Jewish communities, do not go in with riot gear, do not use tear gas and bullets against them. But Palestinians, even demonstrations of Palestinian children, Israeli forces are dressed in riot gear, they use tear gas, they use rubber-coated steel bullets, and they use live ammunition because they have so dehumanized the people that they are colonizing. And these are the tactics that our police officers are being trained in. And so, yes, when we see, you know, American police officers coming into our communities in riot gear and using tear gas and chokeholds and knees to the neck on us, it reminds us of what we see in Palestine and reminds us of that dehumanization, that just complete lack of respect for human life.
It's also quite a remarkable fact that the New York Police Department, and in looking into this issue, I'd never heard this before, but the New York Police Department has its own branch in Israel. I mean, this also speaks to how much money our police departments have. This is a part of the call by Black Lives Matter activists to start defunding the police. They have so much money. Why is the New York Police Department opening up branches in other countries? They're not a university or a chain store.
You're exactly right. And this is what's so disturbing, what so many people don't know, how our tax dollars are being used to, you know, instead of to invest in our community, to it's invested in violence.
Middle East Eye pointed out that New York Police Department's Muslim surveillance program, which we saw after the September 11th attacks, was modeled in part on Israel's surveillance program used on Palestinians in the West Bank. It's not just deadly tactics like chokeholds, it's also surveillance. And whether how have lawmakers from both parties here in the U.S. not just overlooked this participation, this collaboration between Israel and American police forces, but actively encouraged it and celebrated it?
Exactly. You know, I'm starting to see some cracks in that. And so hopefully that will change. But for decades, Israel has been a bipartisan issue, and the pro-Israel lobby has really celebrated that. It's not a Democrat or Republican. It is, you know, it's unquestionable, our alliance with Israel. And even some progressive, you know, candidates that you see or representatives, they always have to start everything with talking about how great our alliance is with Israel. And they usually do that by talking about our shared values, our shared values. And the problem is that is not the shared values that I think you and I and most Americans have of human rights, dignity, freedom. We see that it is shared values of settler colonialism, violence, occupation, racism, and we need to break through that. And when this country now, I hope we're at a moment in history where this country is coming to terms with its, or at least beginning to come to terms with its very violent and settler colonial past, and hopefully make amends as we move forward. I think it's incumbent upon us, you know, Palestinian activists and others and our allies, to also start to call out these people that claim they are for equality, dignity, and human rights, and yet overtly support and unquestionably support a you know, such a big human rights abuser as Israel. And it's not just human rights abuses. I've said it here. It is this whole system of colonizing the land and wanting to get rid of the people. You give no value to Palestinian human life. And that I hope is going to begin to change as we do the work here that's needed, recognizing that, you know, our freedom, our liberation is tied to people around the world. We are all human beings, and the violence that the U.S. government and the official state and even on a local level have been inflicting on mainly Black and Brown and immigrant bodies here in the United States, it is not detached from the violence that the U.S. also exports. So we import and export violence. And so let us know what's happening in these countries around the world that's being supported by our tax dollars, and connect those struggles and start to see victories when we break them down, break down these systems. That is the work that's being done. And that just gives me so much hope, especially seeing the young generation that is so vocal and out there and not demanding, demanding, but not accepting to be silenced. And I hope that increases. But you're absolutely right to go back to what you said. It's been a bipartisan issue. It is partly because of the power of the pro-Israel lobby, which we are also seeing start to crack as people become more connected and organize more around social justice issues and start to elect more progressives that don't, you know, accept big money and so that are not in the pockets of these lobbies that work to maintain this kind of supremacy and oppressive systems that just can't exist in the world that we live today.
So let's talk about the political upset in New York recently during the primary elections, when a longtime congressman, very high up in the ranks, Elliot Engel, was defeated in the primary by a newcomer, by Jamal Bowman. First of all, what has Elliot Engel's legacy in Congress been on the issue of Israel-Palestine?
He is touted as really one of Israel's biggest, most hawkish supporters. And we saw that, we saw not only kind of the establishment Democrats, but even some Republicans and whatnot, they began to shake and dump a lot of money into his campaign. The pro-Israel lobby dumped millions into his campaign because he has been kind of uncompromising and hawkish on Israel. And not, I mean, foreign policy in general, really, he has supported continued the militarization and support of sending military weapons and money to Saudi Arabia to continue killing, bombing Yemeni civilians. He was against the deal with Iran. He, anything that Israel puts up, even, you know, during Obama's presidency, there was kind of a noted rift between former President Obama and Netanyahu. And he was not with his party. He was a staunch supporter of Israel. It is whatever Israel wants. He was a very vocal supporter also of the attack in the war against Iraq. He's just very hawkish and violent on foreign policy, supposedly a little bit better on domestic policy, but he is completely bought out, if not bought out, then very misguided morals. And what we saw was, yes, Jamal Bowman coming up, put forth by really progressives, a school principal, a supporter of many social justice issues, not someone with any kind of big money. Even he would say, talking about his background and being raised by a single mother and not the kind of person you would expect to be in Congress, but the big push behind of grassroots activists, not big money. He was even able to confront endorsements by Elliot Engel was endorsed by Hillary Clinton, was endorsed by Nancy Pelosi, by Chuck Schumer, these big names in the Democratic Party, and sadly also sorry to say, the Congressional Black Caucus all lined up behind Elliot Engel, but it was the power of the people and the organizing and people that are tired of the establishment Democrats and, you know, and what they have been doing. They have not really been standing up for the average people, and they have not worked for people to dismantle kind of the violence that we see in our, especially the Black and Brown communities, an enormous, a historic victory for Jamal. And this has, I believe, the Israel lobby very worried, because it's not just, also Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who has been a very, very vocal critic of Israel, and the lobby put forth people to primary her, and she won overwhelmingly.
Right, and her survival of her first primary, but not just survival, she literally won by a landslide, is also an indication that being critical of Israel is no longer a sort of a death mark on your candidacy. There was a time when even the slightest, I mean, I remember a time when even the slightest critique of Israel's treatment of Palestinians was enough to disqualify any candidate, or they, you know, basically had to make up for it or compensate for it by walking back their statements and apologizing in order to have any chance of winning any elections. That seems to not be as true anymore, at least as per Jamal Bowman, AOC, and, you know, other members of Congress, such as Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar as well.
Yes, who both have also, are both being primaried. And we expect, personally, I expect this to continue because I'm noticing, and I'm working with these just slew of young, progressive, very active people who really, really want change and are tired of big money, big corporations, and these lobbies that don't have the interest of the people, of us, the middle class, the poor, don't have our interests in mind. And we're tired. We're tired of it. And so the organization that is going around getting people really from the community elected to represent our voices, this means that then those people are accountable to us and not accountable to the lobbies and the big money that has so devastated and oppressed us. And obviously they're also oppressing people around the world. I expect that trend to continue. So it's a really hopeful sign. I see it as a very hopeful sign. And for someone who's been campaigning on Palestinian rights for a couple of decades now, it's just been it's a monumental shift. As you say, you remember two decades ago. Yeah, I remember you couldn't even say anything. Even in the streets, not many people were very aware or conscious of the Palestinian issue. Now, when I go to protests in the streets against police brutality, against, you know, for Black Lives Matter, I carry a sign, you know, Palestinians for Black Liberation or Palestinians for Black Lives. And everybody around me is so supportive because I think we've had a historic tie. Our communities have been historically tied in struggle. But I think especially during the Oslo years of the Palestinian, what they call peace process, some of that really was dampened. And now we see that that's all a sham, and it's the power of the people that have to get back into the streets
in terms of Jamal Bowman's position on Israel and Palestine, he has been careful still to not align himself fully with the Palestinian struggle for freedom. For example, he said, "I personally oppose the BDS movement," but he said that he supports Americans' constitutional right to boycott. Are you worried about that?
I'm not. I recall that, you know, Representative Ilhan Omar and even Rashida Tlaib's Palestinian didn't really come out vocally for BDS until after they secured their elections. This is not to mean that they, I don't recall them saying anything opposed to it before they were elected. But sometimes you are a bit more careful to draw the biggest coalition. But even if he is personally against boycott, divestment, sanctions, and I think he is kind of, he has more of a social justice mentality. He has been in the fight. And therefore, I think that we can do some work, and it is incumbent upon us to do more work to educate him about the importance of this. So it's either, you know, he was being politically careful during this campaign period, or he really is opposed to it, and we really need to do some work to educate him on why he needs to be out in support of it.
Finally, Huwaida, there is, you know, still sadly a bit of a media blackout, or quite a bit of mainstream media blackout on the issue of Israeli oppression toward Palestinians. And I'm wondering if you can just end by telling us a little bit about one high profile incident of violence, in Israel-Palestine that shocked those people who've been looking at this issue, and that is the Israeli killing of Ahmed Erekat, whose death was unfortunately violently captured on video. He died right on the streets in full view in broad daylight. Tell me about this incident and how it has shaken people.
Yes, thank you, Sonali. Ahmed Erekat is a 27-year-old young man engaged to be married. It's high profile because of his relations to the Palestinian chief negotiator, Saab Erekat. He's his nephew, and he's also the cousin of a very good friend, who also your listeners might know, Palestinian-American legal scholar and activist, Noura Erekat. It was the day of his sister's wedding. No, and he lives in the Palestinian town of Abu Dis, which is a neighborhood of Jerusalem, but it's part of Jerusalem, but Palestinians can't get to Jerusalem. So they are prevented by checkpoints and a wall from going from this Jerusalem neighborhood into the heart of Jerusalem. And therefore, if they want to go to Bethlehem or other cities, Palestinian cities and towns that are adjacent, they have to go around a very long and dangerous road where there's also an Israeli checkpoint. So between Palestinian cities and towns, there are Israeli soldiers, military checkpoints stationed. He was going on his way to pick up his sister and his mother from the salon. They had to go to the salon in Bethlehem. And, you know, to bring her to the home where there was going to be festivities, singing, dancing, and then taking her to her groom. So he was running around. I believe he had also rented or borrowed a car. And he was at this checkpoint on the way to the salon. And when it was his turn to come up to the soldiers, we don't know, maybe he lost control of his car. The video that the Israeli military shows him it kind of moving forward and then suddenly turning into and crashing into the checkpoint. And this, the Israeli military is trying to say, this is evidence of Ahmed trying to commit an attack. This is that he was, and they labeled him a terrorist trying to commit an attack. Anyone in any kind of rational mind who considers Palestinians human would first say, I wonder what happened. Like, how did he lose control of his car that way? Not, he's an automatic terrorist. I mean, he was going less than 5-10 miles an hour. You could not have created, you could not have carried out any kind of decent attack, let's say. Sorry about the choice of words, but he wasn't going to really hurt or kill anyone in that kind of attack. So it made no sense that this was a calculated attack on Israeli soldiers.
And they just shot him while he lay on the ground. He just came right out of the car, fell to the ground, and they shot him where he lay.
He crashed into the checkpoint. So Israeli soldiers with their guns are also barricaded in this military installation, which he crashed into, got out of the car, and the video that Israel released, he is all pixelated out. You can't see him, probably because they didn't want you to see that he was completely unarmed, a young man, no malintentions. He got out of his car. You know, he just got into an accident. You get into an accident, you get out of your car. And they shot him dead. All of these soldiers with their guns, this unarmed man shot him dead, no questions asked. And that's how they operate. It's shoot first and not even question later. It's shoot first, then malign and lie later, which is what they're trying to do now by saying that he's a terrorist. And even if they were afraid for their lives, these armed soldiers were afraid of this young unarmed man and could not detain him without killing him, witnesses say he was left to bleed on the ground for over an hour. They would not let any other Palestinians come forward to help him. They would not get an ambulance to help him. His father was called to the scene by witnesses. They would not let his father get to his body. They let him bleed out on the ground and die. This is the extent to which Palestinians have been dehumanized. And then now they're out to say, well, he was a terrorist, and to justify this attack. And they won't be investigated, these soldiers. They won't be prosecuted, because we've seen this over and over and over again. One of the most egregious cases is a 13-year-old girl in Gaza that was shot dead in 2005. Iman al-Hams, a captain in the Israeli military, emptied his magazine into her body, 17 bullets. Why? Because she ventured a little bit too close to an area they considered a security zone, and she was carrying a backpack. And he was cleared of all charges. The military supposedly investigated. He was cleared of all charges, even though he said even if she was 3 years old, he would have done the same thing. Because no matter who you are, a Palestinian is a potential terrorist.
And just to bring this full circle to our conversation, so much of what you're describing about Israeli treatment of Palestinians is reminiscent of U.S. police's treatment of Black Americans. And, you know, the parallels are starkly there, both, of course, funded by U.S. tax dollars. Huwaida, I want to thank you so much, as always, for joining us. Always appreciate your insight and having you on.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
My guest has been Huwaida Araf, Palestinian-American lawyer and human rights activist, co-founder of the International Solidarity Movement, former chair of the Free Gaza Movement. She's currently the Palestine and Refugees Correspondent for Rising Up. We've been discussing how American police learned their deadly tactics from Israeli forces, among other issues. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.